Thank you, Chair, and hello to the Commission and Director and Deputy Director. I'm going to share my screen here. And hopefully you guys can see that okay.
It looks good.
Thank you. All right. I'm here today to talk a little bit about southern resident killer whales and the rulemaking process we're undergoing right now to develop rules for the new licensing program for commercial whale watching. But first, some fun updates. We currently, with the addition of J35 Tahlequah's new calf, J57, just news from last week, we are up to a SRKW population of 73. We did lose one of the southern residents this year as well. But also exciting news from last week, and we had a super pod, which is when members of all three pods come together and are co-mingling, which hasn't happened as frequently recently, and so that was really exciting for folks to see. As was mentioned in public comment this morning, there have been a lot of new, less experienced recreational boaters on the water this summer, and so we've been really trying to get the word out, and you can see on the right there, there's a press release that DFW issued about giving pregnant killer whales space. Several members of each pod have been shown recently to be pregnant, including J35 before she gave birth. And so we're really trying to make sure that the boaters who are out there who may have less experience boating around whales understand what the distance and speed regulations are and how to recognize and act appropriately around whales. So I'm going to do a brief big picture orientation and then zoom in to our rulemaking focus. Southern resident killer whales face a variety of threats to their recovery. Primarily, they're not getting enough food. So finding and creating enough opportunities for them to find their primary source of food, they like Chinook quite a bit, is a main priority. They also are threatened by a lot of pollution and contaminants in both their food and the water, and then disturbance and noise, which affect their ability to use echolocation to find fish and to communicate, socialize, and rest. The Governor's Orca Task Force met for 2 years and came up with a variety of recommendations. Priorities were those that I just mentioned. When they resumed in 2019, they also talked about some of the bigger picture threats like growing human population and climate change. 2018, though, they produced 36 recommendations, and that's the genesis for the rulemaking I'm talking about today. 13 additional recommendations came out in 2019, which brings the total to 49, and there's progress being made on a wide variety of those recommendations. The 2018 recommendations resulted in 4 governor request bills in 2019. These are them: one focused on oil transportation safety, one focused on habitat and increasing Chinook salmon, another focused on toxic pollution prevention, and the notable one for you today is the one second substitute Senate Bill 5577 on reducing vessel disturbance and noise. And that comes in right here, recommendation 18, establish a limited entry whale watch permit system. The final legislation did not make a limited entry system, but developing rules that essentially help the commercial whale watch industry do their part to contribute to recovery. This vessel bill as well addressed some of the other vessel related threats. It created those new distance and speed regulations that I was mentioning earlier that apply to all vessels. So the bill did several things related to commercial whale watching. It defines fees per operator and per vessel. It requires DFW to adopt rules for license holders, and it gives us some things to consider when making rules. It requires us to convene an independent science panel and use that best available science. And down the road in 2022, 24, and 26, we need to report back on the effectiveness of not only the whale watching system, the rules around commercial viewing of southern resident killer whales, but also those broader vessel regulations. If you're curious about the fee schedule, this is what was defined in the bill. You can see that there's a base license fee and then fees per boat or per number of kayaks. And so several businesses have multiple boats. And so you kind of just add and do the math for each company of the primary license plus per boat. And then alternate operators are also defined in the bill. And there's a fee for them and they're able to work for multiple companies. We don't have limits on that. The revenue from this program will go to the state wildlife account. We're currently in process of developing the wild system that will allow us to sell these licenses and generate cards and things along those lines. Just as an FYI industry stats, there are 29 members of the Pacific Whale Watch Association that covers the bulk of the commercial whale watch industry. And that's split between the US and British Columbia. So we're not sure yet how many of the Canadian operators will apply and get licenses in the Washington system. It will be required for all operators who are viewing any whales in Washington state waters. And so currently, a lot of these operators do cross both sides of the border to view species. There are over 100 vessels in the current whale watching fleet. If you narrow in and look at the Washington-based businesses, we have 15 primary motorized vessel-based businesses and around 12 kayak businesses. The bill defined what they mean by several of the terms, including sustainable whale watching, which focuses both on shore and vessel-based whale watching that provides a recreational and educational experience. So we're really trying to strike a balance here, as you all know, and is in so much of our work, between making sure we meet the conservation bar and we're doing everything possible there, and also creating opportunities for these value-added educational experiences and in industry. Narrowing in, we must adopt rules for holders of the commercial whale watch license regarding the viewing of southern resident killer whales. So this is the really narrow focus at the whales, making sure the industry is doing their part to reduce those vessel disturbance and noise impacts. And so you can see there, that's the center of the bullseye. And that's been a big focus because the licensing program fees and requirements have largely been defined in the bill, that broader second circle there, and those broader vessel regulations. We're getting feedback, you know, a lot of folks want to continue to work on those broader vessel regulations. Folks are still interested in the structure of this program. It's new, it's the first time we're doing a licensing program for this industry. But this rulemaking process that I've been largely involved in over the past year has really focused on that bullseye. And where are we in the process? So there was the CR 101, which we filed late last fall. And then we've been undergoing this process in between then and now to get public input, to generate a whole bunch of different ideas and alternatives for what these rules should be, to analyze and get the best available science to use in the rulemaking process. And right now we're almost at this point of filing the CR 102. So, as you stated earlier, this is a briefing. I will be coming back to you later this fall when we'll actually discuss the proposed rules and then hopefully make a decision in December of this year. There has been a lot of different stuff going on in this rulemaking process, and we have multiple parallel tracks going. At the far right end there, you see the DFW licensing system development and preparations for all of that. And I'm pretty excited for how that system will work and how we'll be able to serve the needs of our customers there. On the rulemaking piece itself, we have an advisory committee, an intergovernmental coordination group, an independent science panel run through the Washington State Academy of Sciences. And then we have some contract support to do the CEPA process and multiple economic analyses. And all of those things together are informing this rulemaking. And I'm going to talk about each of them briefly. First, the independent science panel from the Washington State Academy of Sciences. The rule defines that we must use best available science in the establishment of the Southern Resident Orca whale watching rules and we need to continue to adaptively manage the programs. That's part of that reporting back on effectiveness. We might also recommend changes to these rules based on the results we're seeing. And so it's really important to have recommendations and the best available science compiled for us. That is where the Washington State Academy of Sciences has come in. We have, and this gear diagram here is meant to represent that this is very iterative. So we have the advisory committee, they've generated multiple alternatives and straw proposals. The science panel has provided feedback on those. The science panel also informed the advisory committee as they were meeting. And now as we've moved further into the process, as we at WDFW are developing alternatives, the science panel is giving us feedback and sharing their report of best available science with us. That report just came out within the last month. The Academy issued their summary of research findings. You can see also there the names of the committee members. We got some really great folks who are meeting with the Academy and informing them in this process. And they've provided a lot of different input, and they've also received input. They hosted two workshops, one for scientists to make sure that they understood the full body of research that they should be considering and reviewing, and one also with stakeholders. As I said, they did Q&A for the advisory committee, and they've reviewed iteratively some of the proposals we put forward. Forthcoming, they're going to provide adaptive management recommendations later this month, and they're going to review the draft regulations and public comments as they relate to the science and the best and the use of best available science. And so it's really great to have these folks on board as a resource for this rulemaking process to make sure we're adequately using the science. The advisory committee consists of 11 members, pretty much split between industry and non-industry folks, several from environmental NGOs that were heavily involved in the task force process, and also members of the public. The advisory committee was designed to inform DFW, hopefully issue a recommendation to DFW about rules, which then we were hoping to then pass on to you. They came up with some really cool inputs right at the beginning of our process. They gave some best case, kind of like future driven, what were their values and what were they hoping this program and these rules would achieve. They also came up with best case 2030 news headlines. And you can see in these examples here that they were hoping that the licensing program and these rules can leverage the industry to be partners in the conservation of southern resident killer whales. We also had them generate near-term news headlines for at the end of this process. It's just getting implemented. What are we hoping folks will be saying about this? And we're hoping, and they're hoping, that we get it right. It's a good balance of the needs of conservation, and it is an example of the industry with the states in this conservation role.
Julie, if I may, Commissioner Graybill has his hand up with a question.
Thank you. I'm sorry, Larry, that was left over from our previous discussion.
Okay, pardon the interruption, Julie.
No problem. This slide I have up now shows the structured decision-making process that we used with the advisory committee. So starting out by establishing a process and a charter for how we wanted to work together, working to understand the shared context. So we have presentations from the industry, from the science community, from specific pieces of the industry, including the kayak world, from DFW enforcement. All of that helped us to get a common understanding of the world we're working in and how things have changed on the water, in the science, and in the broader community and the legal and administrative environment over the past 20 years, and how we hope they'll continue to evolve. We determined values and criteria for evaluating options, and then worked in generating, I would say, probably 10 to 15 different alternatives that we then compared and contrasted, tested and refined, and worked towards a recommendation. I would be remiss if I didn't draw attention to COVID and how it impacted this process. We were able to meet twice before the stay home order went into effect. And that did change the tenor of the conversation. It was a detriment in that we couldn't have those in-person interactions and facilitated activities that I was hoping to do throughout the rest of this process. But it was also a major advantage in that we were able to get more public participation very early in this process and throughout all of the meetings, which went on until July 8th was their last meeting. So at the end of the day, the advisory committee was not able to come to a consensus recommendation. They worked really hard and tried their best to find compromises that met all of their mutual needs. They ended up with two compromise proposals that were as close as they could get to compromise. And we sent those two proposals to the science panel, who provided a review, which was really informative. And this whole process has been extremely informative, even though they weren't able to produce a consensus recommendation. I'm continuing to consult with them currently and hopefully throughout the rest of the rulemaking process as my primary advisors and sounding board for the options that we're hoping to put forward to you later this year. The Intergovernmental Coordination Group has also been extremely valuable. That group includes a lot of our states, local and federal, and transboundary Canadian partners. Canada has not yet implemented a licensing program for commercial whale watching, and so they're keeping tabs on our process. And we're hoping that by remaining in coordination, we can have cumulative transboundary benefits to the SRKW. These whales go back and forth across the border. There are whale watchers on both sides of the border. We want to make sure that our rules work in harmony with what our counterparts in Canada are doing. This group has also been really helpful with some of the implementability sideboards and other more, I guess, legal challenges that we might face in this rulemaking process. And a good example of that is geographic restrictions is one of the things we're considering in the rulemaking process for where commercial whale watch operators can and can't operate or can and can't view southern resident killer whales. And a good example of that is the Coast Guard weighing in on that issue and helping us understand the interactions with geographic closures in the shipping lanes. DFW enforcement has also been extremely helpful in thinking through which of the options are implementable and what might be some of the challenges that they face on the water. The economic analysis consists of two parts. The rules, the legislation directed us to consider the economic viability of license holders. And so we have a really great contractor, IEC, that has been analyzing what does viability mean. And essentially at this very broad level, they're looking at whether the compliance costs of complying with different rule options would reduce profitability to zero. And so they provided that analysis. It was really helpful. Quick summary, I recommend reviewing this if you're interested. But some of the big things that could affect viability of the industry is if we have requirements that force them to hire new and additional staff, if we create large-scale closures beyond the ones that they already are in compliance with. There's an existing voluntary no-go zone that most of the, or that the industry is in compliance with right now. And if we require the purchase of AIS during this particularly difficult year where the industry has faced a major downturn because of the effects of COVID and the stay-home order and all of the social distancing requirements. And so that's something we're trying to be really cognizant of as we proceed in this rulemaking process. The other piece of the economic analysis is the Small Business Economic Impact Statement, which is a requirement of the Regulatory Fairness Act. And this is looking at whether there are more than minor costs that will be imposed as a result of the rulemaking. There are several pieces of this analysis.
Chair Carpenter, could I ask a quick question?
Go ahead, Commissioner Thorburn, please.
I'll just go ahead now. I probably missed it earlier. AIS, to me that means aquatic invasive species. What does it mean to you?
essentially it's automatic system. It's the way, it's like GPS for on the water. It's a way to know where boats are.
And thank you.
Of course. Thank you, Commissioner. And that's another relevant piece around AIS specifically, is that about half of the industry on the US side currently already has AIS systems installed on their vessels because of the Coast Guard requirements of vessels of a certain size that must have it. So half of the industry on the US side does not yet have it, half does. Most if not all of the Canadian operators are already required to have AIS on board. All right, so SBEIS, again, this relevant to this is that AIS is more than a minor cost. There are two types of these systems. There's AIS type A, which is required, the kind required by the Coast Guard. And then there's AIS type B. And type B is the kind that the Coast Guard can turn on and off on their display because they're smaller vessels, maybe less important to what the Coast Guard is trying to track. Helpfully, those units, the AIS type B, are also much cheaper. They're around the $750 range versus the AIS type A, which is much more expensive. Still, that's something we're considering, particularly during a year where there's already an economic downturn. So the SBEIS covers what are all these different things that could cause those types of costs? What are the exact rules the agency is considering? How might those affect the industry specifically? And what are some steps, mitigation steps, we can take to reduce those economic impacts as they relate disproportionately to small businesses? Finally, we have the SEPA process, which you guys are all familiar with. So far, we've gone through the scoping phase and got a good deal of public comment there that informed our advisory committee deliberations and generation of alternatives. And we're currently finalizing preparation of the draft environmental impact statement, EIS, which will be published in the very near future, and we'll be getting public comment on that document through the fall. And this document analyzes a variety of different alternatives that DFW is exploring and their various impacts on environmental variables, both on the whales and on recreational interests in this case. So I want to get a little bit into the content of what we're considering, and that'll be about it for my presentation. So the legislation directs us pretty clearly that the rules must be designed to reduce the daily and cumulative impacts of commercial whale watching on southern resident orcas and consider the economic viability of license holders. The rule or the legislation also defines specifically some things that we need to consider. We don't have to make rules in all of these areas, but we need to at least think through options, which we definitely have been. So some of those things that we need to at least consider are the number of operators that can view southern resident orcas at a time. So we think of that as within a certain bubble, how many commercial operators, how many vessels are coming and going. And the science has pointed to the impact, that being one of the really big variables that influences the impact of vessels, is how many are within 1,000 meters or a half nautical mile of southern resident killer whales. The number of days and hours that commercial whale watchers can operate, also providing significant daylight foraging hours where there are no vessels nearby would be ideal for reducing the impact of vessels on southern residents. Again, the lever we have control of in this rulemaking is not all vessels, but the commercial vessels. So that's something we're thinking about as well. Duration spent in the vicinity of southern resident orca whales and the areas in which they can operate. And we're really trying to optimize what we get through this rulemaking process and the system. As I mentioned, we're really narrowing in. The rules have to meet that center bullseye of reducing the impacts of commercial whale watching vessels on the species. But beyond that, we need to make sure they're implementable and enforceable. We can adaptively manage them and report back to the legislature. And if we can, it would be great to get value-added benefits from this system that provide indirect effects benefiting SRQW. And I've provided a couple examples of that here. One is the whale report alert system. This is a really cool thing that's come out of BC and it's growing in use here in the US. And it is a system through which sighting information is fed to a system that then tells the big liners and commercial shipping vessels when whales are present so that they can slow down and avoid collisions. So that's a really important function. Having eyes on the water can feed into that system. Additionally, the use of the whale warning flag. San Juan County MRC is really promoting this flag as a way to warn recreational boaters and everyone out there that whales are present and to slow down and to be mindful of the distance regulations. And whale watchers using this flag could provide added benefits that influence recreational boaters so that we maybe reduce those impacts as well. But again, we're really narrowing in first and foremost on making sure that we've reduced the impact of the commercial whale watching vessels themselves. So this is just another list of many of the things we're considering. And I'll give you an example of what some of those look like. This is from the CEPA document, we're considering a variety of alternatives under each of these variables. So the number of vessels that can view SRKW at once, we can make that very restrictive, down to periods where there are no viewing at closer than half nautical mile, one or two vessels, all the way up to a less restrictive approach where it's 5 to 10. Last year, the average number of commercial vessels was at, I believe, 4.8, and that was due in large part to the industry voluntarily reducing and showing that they're the stewards of the species. But there are currently no rules that limit the number of commercial vessels that can be around orcas at one time. Hours, again, restricting daylight hours to provide undisturbed feeding and foraging and communication and rest times is another thing we can do. And there's a variety of different ways we could think of that. It could be a daily period of a few hours, the whole way up to just cutting off sunrise and sunset so that there's no viewing during limiting viewing conditions. Again, geographic restrictions. There's an existing voluntary no-go zone along the west side of San Juan Island that extends a quarter mile and a half mile from the Lion Kiln Lighthouse. The industry is voluntarily following the voluntary no-go zone at the moment. So we could formalize that and make it an official requirement. We could close additional areas based on San Juan County is doing a marine spatial planning effort right now. The more we learn about important foraging areas, that might influence potential closures as well. Ideally, what we're thinking of doing is not just picking one of those things, but to nest them in order to optimize the conservation value while providing some kind of viewing opportunity. So we could have variable viewing hours during different seasons, potentially limiting it more during some times that are key foraging times or times of prey scarcity, and having more viewing hours during other parts of the year. We could also do a variable number of commercial whale watch vessels permitted in the vicinity of southern residents based on the geographic area. And we could also do something along the lines of different restrictions for kayaks based on whether or not SRKW are present. So these are just a couple examples of different ways we could test and combine these different alternatives we're considering to come up with the right set of rules. So we're here. And a lot is about to happen. So I'm glad that I get to talk to you today. We're getting adaptive management recommendations from the science panel this coming week. And then the week after that, we're publishing the CR 102 with draft rules. We're also publishing the small business economic impact statement and the draft SEPA EIS. And we'll open the public comment period, which will go through for the SEPA process through October 23rd. But we'll continue for the rulemaking process through your hearing in December. October 19th, I've scheduled a public meeting in the evening. If any of you are interested in attending that, it'll be both for the SEPA documents and the draft rules. I can send that information through Nikki to you. November, the science panel will be giving us more feedback on the rules. And then in December, we'll go into the hearing on the proposed rules at your December meeting. And then your December 18th conference calls when you have your scheduled decision. January is when we will begin to actually implement these rules. We might need some e-rules to bridge the gap if needed, and we'll be selling licenses. So all of this will be happening, what felt a long time ago, like a long time period, but now it's all kind of coming to fruition. And with that, I will stop. I'll point to, we have a webpage for this rulemaking process. All of the documents that have been produced so far from the science panel and the economic viability analysis are posted there. And I'm happy to answer any other questions you have.
Very well done, Julie. I can't see if any commissioners have their hands up with questions or comments.
Yeah.
Commissioner Smith, please.
Thanks. Yeah, well done, Julie. I was on the task force, so I'm familiar with a lot of the challenges that you've had to deal with, and you've done an excellent job. I just wanted to say that if I can be of any help to you as you're going forward, please feel free just to contact me.
Thank you. That's much appreciated. It would be great to chat with you more sometime soon.
Yeah, I would look forward to that.
Thanks. Well, Julie, you did such a good job. You only got one volunteer out of it, huh? So, if there's no other questions. Oh, Vice Chair Baker. One moment, please. There you go, Julie.
Oh, Julie, that really was a great presentation. And this is an issue that I'm very, very interested in. One of my primary hobbies is kayaking, and I used to kayak up in the San Juans, basically looking out for whales. Haven't been up there in years because it has just gotten too many boats. Now they even have airplanes and helicopters in the sky. It's just too frenetic. So I really appreciate this work and everything that you and the governor and the task force did. My question is, it might have been a couple of years ago now, we had a proposal similar to this, but not about licensed whale watchers, but about fisheries. And I remember that that there was a proposal for not a voluntary, but a no-go zone on the west side of San Juan Island at that time for certain fisheries. And I also believe that we did not approve that policy. I'm not sure if it was a policy or a rule. I don't really remember. But my question is, does what we're doing with these whale watchers have any interface with commercial fishing?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that. So right now, the rules will only affect commercial whale watch vessels. The no-go zone is a really good example, though, of where those interactions get closest, because you're right in that the no-go zone was considered in the past and has not moved forward as an official law that applies to everyone. And in part, that was because of the interaction with fishers and particularly tribal fishermen who need historic access to their fishing grounds. And so restricting all vessels' access to that no-go zone is something that would require a lot more policy consideration. However, thankfully, I've had tribal input through the Intergovernmental Coordination Group process and been able to chat with a few folks. And it's not believed that the restricting commercial whale watch access to that area will cause problems for tribal fishermen. And so that is something we're being sensitive to. I'm glad I have that consultation ability with the tribes to make sure that we're working in lockstep there. But right now, it should not affect fishing in any way.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Julie, job well done. Keep up the good work. We'll look